Our liberties we prize, and our rights we will maintain. This is Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast, where we tell stories about the contribution Iowans and the state of Iowa has made to advance the civil rights movement. Past stories are being told, present actions will be highlighted, and preparation for the future will be discussed. Here is your host, Eric Anyange.
Welcome to the Iowa Civil Rights History Podcast. My guest today is Mr. Jim Tillman. He's a historian, storyteller, and the author of two books, The Black Experience, 1950s, Sioux City, Iowa, The Journal of African American History, Volume 1 in Sioux City, Iowa. Our conversation today will be on Jim's life and the Sioux City Ghost, which was all-black fast-pitch softball team started back in 1925 right here in Sioux City. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eric. Glad to be here.
So you and I, we have a couple things in common. Love history, love the art of storytelling. How did you fall in love with history?
That's a good question. If I fell in love with history, I fell in love with video. Video led me to history. I mean, I've been into video over 40 years. I started off in the home market, weddings, okay, anniversaries, high school sports events. And after, you know, you document so much footage so many years in different events, then it's like you have all this information and you want to get it out to people in a booklet form, in a video form, in some type of multimedia form. So then that's really when I started looking at history and, you know, the research I was learning, I can share it with others. And that's really essentially what we do. We're just sharing information.
So the video part of it is what led you slowly to start uncover some historical things locally?
Absolutely. And specifically, it was the video interview. Okay, so that was a skill that's very important. You know, I would interview the oldest African-American citizen that I knew in Sioux City.
Sioux City.
So we're talking 90 years old, 89, that type of thing.
Yeah.
That's incredible information because they were there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they saw it firsthand. I just know it from my research. I've seen some things firsthand, but, you know, I'm not 90-some years old now. So
you are OG according to your book.
Absolutely. I'm a young OG.
There you go, young OG. Yeah, and you know, there's a very important part of hearing the storytelling piece. You're interviewing people who actually lived at a specific time in history, and they can tell you from their own mouth.
Yes.
And I think that's another form of storytelling we lost.
Powerful form.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to, I believe it was, you know, Native Americans, the oral history,
mm-hmm,
and a lot of different cultures.
Yeah.
It was the oral history.
Yes.
You know, we're around campfires. You know, we just want to put it in book form,
mm-hmm,
in video form, flash drive form.
Because otherwise you lose it.
It's gone.
Yeah. Did I read this right? Your grandfather migrated in Sioux City?
Yes.
Years ago?
Exactly. George Arthur Daniels, he's how our family got to Sioux City, Iowa. In 1912, in Forsyth County, Georgia, his family was one of 1,100 black families that got run out of Forsyth County, Georgia.
Georgia, okay.
In 1912. I asked Mom all these years, where was Grandpa born at? Where was he? You know, and it was always Atlanta, Georgia. Well, it wasn't Atlanta, Georgia. When they got run out of Forsyth in 1912, they went from Forsyth County, Georgia to Atlanta. Okay, and in Atlanta, you know, back then was no picnic, but it, you know, you had to get out.
1912, yep.
And go somewhere. So anyway, they were in Atlanta, and yeah, from Atlanta to Sioux City in 1918, that's when he arrived. And he arrived by, his older brother was already here. So that's usually the connection.
What?
18 years old.
Oh, he was 18 years old.
18 years old. And on his 18th birthday, he started his career at Armour's packing plant. Packing plants were employment for blacks. That's what drew
a lot of people, lot of black people to, to Sioux City.
Yes, absolutely. And that was his only job.
Until he retired?
Until he retired. So that's how we got here. And he married his wife, Ethel Daniels, my grandmother, in Sioux City. And she came from Alabama to Sioux City. And her
story, so they met here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yes, they met here.
I want to go back to your childhood. Mm-hmm. You were adopted as a kid.
Yes.
As a baby. How old were you when you got adopted? Were you baby?
Baby. I was conceived in Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah.
My biological mom went to, I believe at the time it was Florence Crittenden Home in Sioux City, Iowa. And that's where unwed mothers came to give their baby up for adoption. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Ironically, all these years later, you know, with ancestry DNA and that type of thing, I reconnected with them. And that's a tricky thing because, well, I don't know those people.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know me.
They don't know you, yeah.
And I'm sensitive enough that I don't want to just appear and
Make them feel guilty.
Well, and just upset their life.
When did you find out you were adopted? Was your adopted parents?
She told us as young as we could comprehend it.
Okay.
And she was always, you know, if I wanted to find out my biological parents,
the door was open.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, okay. Absolutely. But I had no
desire.
At all. I mean, I was
other
was
than set. The DNA thing.
Right. And that came later in my life. After mom and dad died, then I started worrying about my health connections.
Yeah.
That type of thing. You know, going to the doctor, you know, they ask these questions. Well, I was adopted. So, that kind of cut that off. But I was able to find out some health issues. And
from your biological parents?
Yes.
Okay.
And actually, my bio mom is still alive.
Yeah, is she still in Minneapolis?
Minneapolis, I believe.
Okay, because I read that in your book. Are you still in touch with her? Once in a while?
No, not in touch at all, because she didn't, what did they call it? I don't know, whatever they have for the adoption term, but no, she didn't want anything to do with me, and that's okay.
It could be.
But see, the DNA, it showed, you know, who my brothers were, sisters, and that type of thing.
Oh, that's also, that can get tricky too.
It got real tricky because I contacted her daughter, and her daughter knew nothing of me. So, and then I just backed off.
Yeah.
So they know I'm here. It wasn't that big a thing. I didn't take it as a personal rejection. No, I don't. But
how old was she when she gave her birth to you? Do you know?
I'm sure a teenager.
Okay. Yeah. So probably that has a lot to do with it.
Right.
Your adoptive father, that's who you call your dad, Charles Tillman.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away very young.
He did.
At 49?
49. You know, I always said I don't want to be like my dad. He had 3 heart attacks.
Oh, wow.
The third and fatal one was at age 49, and I was a senior in high school.
Wow.
17 years old, and I remember I didn't say, God, why me? But I said, why now?
Ooh. Yeah, at 17.
Well, senior year, it's like
right before you graduate.
This is it. College is looking at me, boom, boom, boom. And yeah, it was September 24th, 1975. So it was early in my senior year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was right at the beginning of the school year. That certainly made it challenging. But yeah, his first heart attack, I was in seventh grade at West Junior High School. Pulled out of class in the afternoon. I remember it. You know how they bring the person from the office will bring slips to you and say, you need to come to the office and blah, blah, blah. hour later, I'm up at the hospital looking at my dad. He's got tubes all over his, and I'm like, okay.
Ooh. What did he do for a living?
He worked at Montgomery Wards. That's the main job I remember. And he had part-time jobs because he would have like part-time cleaning jobs. I remember going to the Castle Inn. It was a restaurant. And I remember me and my sister going up there with him at like midnight or, you know, when they're closed. And so we would, oh God, we would get all kind of pop and ice cream. So, hard worker, loved to fish. Mm. His mom lived to be 92. His dad lived to be 76. You know, and you have a heart attack, but he didn't, you know, doctor told him, Charlie, you got to quit eating the fried fish. And he loved fish. He was a fisherman.
Oh.
He was a hunter also. I wasn't a hunter or fisherman.
Oh, you didn't pick up from
him? Oh, no. That wasn't my thing. Now, my older sister would fish, but he'd take me and her fishing, and I'd, you know, eat the snacks and lunch and
just watch them fish.
It was time to go home. I didn't even want to watch them fish. I wanted to go play some baseball or something.
Your mom lived to be what age?
69.
69. Okay, that's still young.
Very young. Very, very young. The daughter of George Arthur Daniels. And I was told by my aunt that my mom took after Grandpa more than any of the kids. Tough, rough. There was no joking around. I mean, I'm grateful that she selected me to be in their family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That's always a great thing when people can open up their heart and taking kids in that is not their own.
Absolutely.
And raise them like their own.
Sure.
It's like, I think that's what makes the society and community a better place.
Right.
Instead of looking out each other.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons, I'm sure, that, you know, when we were teenagers, there was no really desire to, I've got a mom and dad, I'm good.
Yep. In your book, you say, I rebelled against God. What did you mean by that?
September 17th, 1980, my firstborn son died.
In Iowa City?
Iowa City. Had open heart surgery.
Yeah.
You know, when he was born, he was on heart medicine.
Yeah.
But we knew that he would eventually need surgery. The medical term is transposition of the greater arteries. Left ventricle was the right ventricle, and they were switched around. So, yeah, they said about a year old, he'll be big enough to handle the surgery and that type of thing. I remember it was 8 months old. He was just there for a checkup, but he was growing. I mean, it was like, wow. So they felt it was a good time to try the surgery, and he didn't make it. I didn't expect that outcome. The rebellion against God, well, I was saying, there can be no God.
You said that was the darkest day of ever.
Darkest day of my life, sure. I love my baby. The next day, the sun was out. I'm like, why is the sun out? Here's something how God works. So I'm still moping. Probably a week, 2 weeks after the funeral, okay, I get the Sioux City Journal, the daily paper. I'm, you know, usually looking at the sports section first, and then all of a sudden, every day, I started looking at the obituary section.
Mm.
Of all places.
Something that you never done before.
Well.
Once in a while.
Well, yeah, but exactly. But no, it was focused. Okay, so I'm reading the obituaries. That's where the healing started. That's when I realized, oh, somebody else lost a child. Oh, somebody else's dad died at 39.
Mm.
So then it's like, oh, my goodness.
I'm not the only one.
I'm not the only one. Yet.
it still hurt.
Yeah, it wasn't no instant fix or whatever. It was a process. It was a process of years to go through, years where I wouldn't go to the cemetery on Memorial Day, just not dealing with it. But then out of nowhere, one Memorial Day, I'm going this year. And that was a major healing for me. And to this day, the cemetery is a source of strength for me.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I go out there and get strength and guidance and, very peaceful out there. And it's and I like to get out and garden a little bit, so I'll also take care of some of the graves. You know, I'll take care of my parents and that type of thing. But if I see somebody else's, it's like, come on, man, I got to
do something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just want to even honor people when they're gone in that type of way. And it strengthened me. I mean, you go through situations, it's like, well, man, I've been through this.
What is the, what else?
Well, bring it on. Yeah. I mean, and there has been other issues throughout the years that have been challenging.
What is your connection with the Boys and Girls Club in Sioux City? Were you part of it growing up?
Absolutely, absolutely. The Sanford Community Center and the Boys and Girls. Actually, there was no boys and girls.
It was just boys.
It was the boys club. We didn't want girls there.
They added, girls later.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. It's now called the Boys and Girls Clubs of Siouxland. Okay, so they do have, that's where I grew up at. And I owe a lot of my youth, who I am, to the Boys Club.
Okay.
And to the Sanford Community Center. And actually, that's where I'm going to do some summer programs this summer.
Oh, the reading?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's good to go back there and tell the kids, I was just like you. I was a member here.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. As a matter of fact, you will be starting reading program for the youth this summer.
Absolutely.
Is this the first year? The first summer you're starting? How old are you shooting at? And what kind of books are you thinking about?
Sure. Well, Eric, what it is, it's empowering youth through literature.
Mm.
It's a six-week summer program. And really, the main objective of the program is get them to learn the love of reading, learn the love of literature, how it can be a tool for personal growth, creativity, critical thinking. And there's seven key approaches that we're going to use on this. One, it's engaging book selection. So by offering a diverse range of genres, you know, including fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, you know, the program caters to different interests and reading levels. Second is reading aloud.
Mm.
That is an effective method used to introduce the joy of storytelling.
Mm.
Third one would be interactive discussions. You know, the program encourages participants to engage in discussions about
what
they read.
Reading. Yep.
Exactly. It's, yep. So, we're, you know, make sure they're reading and comprehending it. And fourth is book recommendations. We'll give them personalized book recommendations based on their interest and reading level. Fifth, creative activities, incorporates creative activities that encourage the youth to engage actively with the books that they read. And this is really key, author visits, number six.
Oh.
That's really...
Oh, so you're going to have different authors
absolutely.
That are going
to come in. Okay, absolutely. Great. The program organizes author visits, you know, where they can interact directly with their authors.
Yeah.
Not just me.
Mm-hmm. Because you probably have some young authors in your group. They're thinking about becoming an author.
Well, and that's, you hit it right there. The seventh approach is, you know, you give them some reading challenges or some incentives. Read X amount of such and such and you get a pizza or whatever.
Yeah.
So you give them some incentive. But the thing is, at the end of the program, our goal is to have a physical book about our summer.
Okay.
Okay. It might be a 10-page book. It might be a 20-page book. But it'll be of what they put together.
Oh, okay. So everybody's going to put their own, in their own words.
Exactly.
What the program was.
Or I might have a page where they have their family history or something personalized. But it's going to be personalized, but it's going to be a group project also. So at the end of the summer, you know, we not only give them a book, but we recognize them. That's very important.
What age are you looking at?
Probably 10 to 14.
Okay.
Where they can
comprehend
it and be interested in it all summer.
Yeah.
And that type of thing. So yeah, we're gonna try that, and I feel really good about that.
That's good.
So necessary.
Oh yeah, very much so. So where do the kids sign up for the program?
It would be at the Boys Club or at the Sanford Center.
Okay.
Or whatever nonprofit agency. And those are just two examples. Those are my prime examples because I grew up there and I'm connected there already. But it's certainly not limited to that. You know, it could be a summer church youth group, wherever youth are.
Do you have a maximum number of kids you can have? 10, 20, 30, 50?
No.
100? 100. Because that's the thing, too. You might put this thing out there. You think, oh, I might get 10 of them to show up. And all of a sudden, you open up the door, 40. And then you sit there scratching your head. This is good, but I'm the only one.
No, it'll.
You can give me a call, I'll drive.
There you go.
Yeah.
No, I'd be really excited if it just overwhelms me and that type of thing, because I can get the help.
Yeah.
We can adjust the based on the interest. But I think 10, maybe 15 at the most, and usually the nonprofits, the youth agencies have a staff person there.
Okay.
Just for discipline issues. And
you went to Hopkins?
Hopkins Grade School. Absolutely.
Was that the black kids went to that school?
Well, you're right. It was Hopkins and Webster. Okay, Webster on the west side. You know, probably, I don't know, 20 blocks from there or whatever, but kind of Hopkins, Webster, and then on the east side, Irving School, but it was mainly Hopkins and Webster.
What was the population then for the black kids? Because I'm assuming all you guys knew each other. Or was it big enough that some of you guys did not know
each other?
Because between the school, sports, and all the other stuff, you probably bumping on each other a lot.
Right. Well, and the thing is, we went to Hopkins and we were in different grades. So, you know, I wouldn't really interact with them on their grade level, but we'd be at after school at the Sanford Center, at the Boys Club.
Yeah.
In the neighborhood playing games. But yeah, you definitely knew everybody at Hopkins pretty much.
Because that's where the softball team, the famous Colored Ghost, they did most or almost all of their practice there.
That's exactly where they practiced. Yeah, the Sioux City Ghosts, they were an all-black fast-pitch softball team.
Very, very well-known.
Tremendous team.
Famous in the country.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they started here.
They started in Sioux City and began touring the United States, Canada, and Mexico during the 1930s and played until 1956. In that time period, there were different Sioux City Ghost teams, but the original Ghosts, the ones, these were all Sioux City neighborhood kids, all black. And because of their pranks on the softball field, they were a lot of times compared to the famous Harlem Globetrotters. You know, they were an important part of African-American society in Sioux City because, you know, 1930s, that's, you know, the Great Depression.
Yep. So, and there were the huge entertainment.
Exactly.
For people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you get these, 15 black, you know, athletes in the 1930s, 40s, traveling across the
country,
West Coast.
Yeah.
Western.
And they say they were well known even outside Sioux City more than they were known in Sioux City.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They wanted estimated 2,000 games and lost maybe 100.
Wow.
And they played the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted your championship team or all-star team, whoever you've got. And so they would go into these different communities. They would, you know, beat the, you know, softball team. So the crowd would be mad, but then the ghosts would go into their antics and they'd be so comical. The crowd would be cracking up. So they forgot about that they beat their team.
Yeah.
So that was part of the.
Why did they call him ghost? Is there any significant to that or not really?
You know, I've been asked that. And I'm not sure. I can only kind of guess because first it was a Sioux City Ghost basketball team.
Oh, okay.
So that was there was a basketball team, and then there was the softball team. Okay, my guess is, you know, we were spooks.
Okay.
Kind of, they called us spooks.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably, you know, they called them a lot of things back then, but we were known as spooks. That's my guess.
Interesting. I don't know if you know this information. Do we know how much they got paid?
I don't know. I don't know. They did get a percent of the gate receipts.
Okay.
Because these were young men, and they did not want you to, you know, they didn't want married guys with families because of the travel. I mean, they'd be gone on the softball thing for months out of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd get a percent of the gate receipt.
How did they, I can't think of the owner of the team.
Henry Fisher.
Yeah. How did he even go about recruiting these kids? Did he just happen to walk by and see these kids just practicing? It's like, oh, these kids are pretty good.
Well, he had the basketball team.
Oh, he already had the basketball team.
Right. And Henry Fisher, he had a sports management business. So he brought that business to Sioux City. So, yeah.
So it was natural. He already seen it. This kid, they can probably do this nationwide.
Absolutely. But, yeah, he was always – he already had a sports management situation and –
And they went on to win over 2,000 games.
Over 2,000 and lost about 100.
Gosh.
I mean, they, it's incredible.
Do you guys have any piece of their history other than the stuff that has been written?
Very little. Okay. There is, there's not enough.
Because that's a big deal. Because that was before Jack Robinson.
Right, right. And that's, well, speaking of Jackie Robinson, when he broke the color barrier and blacks were, you know, could go to the major leagues, that's when, you know, teams like the Ghosts and there were different softball teams and that type of thing. That's kind of when it went away. But yeah, these guys were on the Ghosts were supreme athletes.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I mean winning that many games.
Exactly.
Oh, man, do we know how old these young men were? The age range?
They were
teens?
Well, 18.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because my uncle, Rudy Lee Sr., he joined them right out of high school.
Oh, your uncle was part of the Ghost?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a major part of the Ghost. He joined them at 18 years old out of Central High School.
What year was it?
That would be 1948.
Okay, so close to the tail end there.
Right.
Okay. So I'm assuming you talked to him. What did he say about that experience? Because he probably got a chance to go around the country, too.
Yeah, and he's the one that said, you know, they didn't want guys with families.
Oh.
They wanted, you know.
Single guys.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Because they want you to commit to be on the road
commit
for that
to
long.
It, and they, you know. Right.
Yeah.
There was a few guys that were married, like the great one of the greatest ghosts of all time, L.J. Favors. He was on the original Ghost team, but he was already married. But he was so good. I mean, he was L.J. Favors and Floyd Fuji Fulton. Those were two of the greatest ghosts ever.
Yeah,
because they've been recognized in the Iowa Hall of Fame and that type of thing.
That's another piece of story. A lot of it got lost. Maybe even bystander might have something like that back then.
You know what? There's probably some person, some city that has some information on the ghost. Maybe
because I'm sure somebody wrote something in all these cities that they were
absolutely
going. But it's like it's gonna be so hard to pull that information to find. It might be in their local library. The story, like, yeah, we interviewed these ghost kids
but that's also the challenge of researching. I know it's out there. Let me.
How do you dig out?
Well, yeah, and one thing is I'm on USA. Newspaper.com. So that's that puts me in touch with most newspapers in America dating back to the 1800s. And you can't always find information in there.
Yeah, I mean, that's why these oral stories, man, to record them, to save them, put them somewhere is very, very important in times like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially nowadays. We've got technology. Oh, yeah. We've got the capabilities.
Yeah. Nowadays, we do not have an excuse.
Thank you.
You know, this is another question. Just get away from the ghost for just 1 second. I wanted to ask you, how should we commemorate the Black history?
As far as...
that month. What should we do on a Black History Month? If Jim get the power to decide.
I have a funny, strange feeling about Black History Month.
Talk to me.
I don't really like it. For one, there's history made every month, every day, every minute by everybody, African-American included.
So you don't think we should be delegate the
Not
month?
Not just February.
We should just say, hey, Black history is American history.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And we should just celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. Now,
all year long.
Now, the national, you know, it's Black History Month, February. So, we're going to talk about it, but we're not going to, I'm going to talk, this is March. I'm talking about Black history now. I had my book signing in July last year. I'm talking about Black history in the summertime. I've got this Empowering Youth Through Literature deal. They're looking at two books about Black history.
So we should not be waiting, putting things on the back burner and say, oh, yeah, we're going to put that on hold until
we don't have
until
time.
February.
We don't have time to wait. We don't have time to wait.
I like that. So what do you think about having Dr. King Day?
Oh, that.
You okay with that?
Oh, absolutely. Oh. Even though, tell you something about that. You know, with the video background, so I've been in video 40-some years, so any Black event or whatever, I've either got a video, a picture of it, or, so I would, it'd be every year, Dr. King program, boom, let's get fired up, boom. And I get fired up, and then I discovered a pattern. I'm like, okay, because I'm, you know, I was not only there, but I documented it. It's on video. So I'm watching it. I have a dream speech. Everybody's so emotionally high and leave there just really, really wanting to, you know, espouse everything that he talked about.
Yeah.
But then it's almost like the next day, it's like, well, that's over. Back to business as usual. It was like just a thing on the calendar. An obligation. Okay, let's get this out of the way so we
check
can...
check the box.
Yeah, so we can... we know we got to do this, but it's great to honor the man, obviously. Yeah. But then once again, it's up to us. If we just...
Amen.
If we just...
sit back.
Stick to February, that's our fault.
Yep, that's true. 365 days.
Sure. And that's not to say we don't honor or embrace other cultures for their months. Yeah. We certainly do.
The ghosts, they were also called Jack the Cleaner?
That was the first sponsor.
Okay.
Okay, before Henry Fisher took over, you know, managing the team, yeah, Jack the Cleaners, they wore uniform shirts, but they had no uniform pants.
I read that.
See, we didn't have a lot of money then. Even the cleaners did. But with the sponsorship of Jack's, you know, the softball team started playing in the tri-state area. So, okay, so you're in Northwest Iowa. Sioux City is tri-state history, Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. See, so that's what kind of makes it unique as far as an Iowa history.
Yeah, because I realized that I was going somewhere over here, and all of a sudden my GPS said, welcome to Nebraska. I'm like, whoa. I'm in Sioux City. What? Is this GPS taking me to the wrong place? And then the place we stopped, the guy was like, yeah, you are right now, you're basically in Nebraska. Once you pass this bridge right here, you're in Sioux City.
Sure.
And if you go this other side, you pass, I don't know, what did he say?
You're in South Dakota.
I'm absolutely. Like, what?
Yeah, you don't have to go that far.
Yeah.
But it's that river. That's the early history of Sioux City. That's what brought people there.
Mm.
The riverboat, deckhands. People, they needed people to do their job.
So Jack was the owner of the cleaning business?
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
It was
okay. That's what I call Jack the
Cleaner. Exactly.
But okay.
So since they had no uniform pants, they wore whatever they owned.
So they'll look exactly the same on the top.
Yeah.
But on the bottom, everybody got whatever they had.
Whatever you could wear.
Oh, wow.
So then what else didn't they have? Well, they didn't have gloves. The only one that had a glove was the catcher. They didn't have any money to get any gloves. Are you kidding? But then once they, you know, started getting gate receipts, type of thing, they got, you know, pants and the whole outfit. They just wanted to play ball.
Yeah.
That's what they did.
So eventually, like in 1956, it just died down?
Well, you know, there was a couple wars in between. The World War II was there, Korean War.
Mm.
That just kind of, and people got older.
I was thinking maybe as the older player getting older, you recruit the young one. Also, the country is changing slowly.
It changed.
Playing softball is not something people.
Right. And the Depression era was over, and, you know, Henry Fisher was older, and so. Life just changes.
Yeah.
But during that time, that was a remarkable time in Sioux. And they put Sioux City on the map.
I know. Around the country.
Absolutely. They're ambassadors. You know, and the ghost is a two-part story. It's one thing what they did on the ball field, and then the other thing is what these men turned into. As far as in the country, in their communities.
Mm, talk to me about that.
You know, a lot of them had talents other than playing softball. A lot of them were musicians, talented singers, talented, instrumentalists. Some of them went into politics. Some of them got positions in the government. So these guys contributed.
To the community.
Exactly.
It was not just hitting the ball.
No, it's these were quality individuals. Did great things.
Did something.
Absolutely.
With their lives.
You know, life wasn't always perfect for the Ghosts. Many of the better players tried to move on to the professional leagues.
Oh, they did? Some of them?
Yeah, but they couldn't because they were black. Okay, so I mean, they were that good.
Yeah.
It's like, man, why can't I?
But that field was not cracked open yet for them.
Not at all.
Get in, yeah.
And also, as I mentioned before, the team had to break up beginning of the Second World War. You know, when many of the players went to the armed forces. So then you experience that. And okay, maybe I don't want to come back
Come back here and play ball.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But
I had William Morris, the grandson of J.B. Morris, on a podcast. And he wrote a chapter on a book, Outside In, about the military in Iowa. And I asked him a question. I'm like, why did these men and women step up to the plate to fight for the country that did not fight for them? Talk to me. So it's like you have those guys that say, you know what? Yeah, we play ball, but we're going to go out there and fight.
You know, that's in my second book, The Black Experience, 1950s in Sioux City, Iowa.
I need that one.
It talks about black patriotism right at the beginning. Here's what it says. As early black historian George W. Williams wrote in 1883, when people spoke of black patriotism in the American Revolution, Negroes were rated as chattel property by both armies and both governments during the entire war. Mm-hmm. This is a cold fact of history.
Oh, yeah.
And is not pleasing to contemplate. The Negro occupied the anomalous position of an American slave and an American soldier. He was a soldier in the hour of danger, but chattel in time of peace.
Wow.
And it was like these African warriors were as useful to the cause of American liberty as slaves were to the cause of American wealth.
Wow.
All these people that I'm writing about, all my grandfather, my dad, my uncles, all these guys that have come before me, and the stuff they had to put up with and the stuff they endured, it's better for me today than it was for my grandfather or my dad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm motivated by, you know, what happened to my son and the ancestors that I'm writing about. They motivate me. Are you kidding me? The stories? And I feel so fortunate just to be able to share it with people. And I used to ask my grandkids, I wanted to know what they were doing for Black History Month. Same thing every year. And I said, okay, I see what this is. But yeah, I wanted to do Black History, but tailor it to
local.
Local, yep. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be critical if every county in Iowa do local Black History.
Exactly, yeah. And that brings me to my next thing. I'd like to go across the state of Iowa this summer, let them know about it.
Oh, yeah. I think that's important. It's like even in Iowa, we know more, I mean, rightfully so, we know more about Dr. King than we know about Alexander Clark.
Right.
But, I mean, like you said earlier, though, it's our responsibility to bring that light. If you have the ability to bring your own history up front, you can't complain when somebody else doesn't.
Exactly.
Or misrepresent the history.
Yep.
Because that's your fault.
And that's what I told people years ago, and they didn't like it. I told them it's not the school's responsibility to teach you your history.
Yep.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. You wrote two books so far. And I think this one, it looks like it's volume one. So I'm assuming you got more coming up.
Absolutely.
The Journal for African American History in Sioux City, Iowa.
Right, right. And actually that came out last July, and then we came out with the Black Experience 1950s in Sioux City, Iowa.
So is that just for the 1950s?
1950s, just the decade.
I'm assuming you're going to do 1960s?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So this is like, I guess, volume two, my second book, to keep things simple. And then before the 60s come out, we're going to have a volume three.
Okay.
That's going to be, it's going to be similar. It's going to be an addition to volume one. In volume one, you know, there are, I think, 105 individual profiles that are in there. I think 40 of the people are still alive, and that's important.
And I like you went from mid-1800, and you came to somebody. This guy's just pretty young.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's important because a lot of people, you know, it's hard to get kids, youth, adults, whatever. We're in 2024, but, you know, why should I care about York in 1804? And that's important. So that's a big time span. But the decade series books, you just compile, 10 years of history, and it's people can relate to it.
Yeah.
Because somebody's grandfather was probably born in the 50s type of thing.
Yep.
But it's, the Black Experience of 1950s in Sioux City is just not about Sioux City.
Yeah.
So I give an overview always of what was happening in America at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And even before we get into the 50s book, we talk about the end of the 40s. What the 40s were about. So you can understand. At the end of the book, we talk about heading into the 60s. It's a series. It'll be a continual series.
What's the purpose of you writing these books? Just to preserve history? Make sure it's not getting lost?
Preserve history I want my grandkids to know who I was.
Okay. Okay.
Because sometimes, you know, I don't want to rely on anybody else to tell them
the story. Yep.
Who I was. They're going to know. They'll tell you who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing, I think, you know, about legacy, you know, why we put so much effort into this right now. Well, we're not going to be here forever. But when we're gone, the books will still be speaking for us.
How many grandkids you got?
I have got a baseball team.
Oh, you okay.
About nine.
Oh, good. So good for you. How many kids you got?
Three? I've got three.
Three, okay. If you have 5 minutes, if the whole world stopped in 5 minutes, all the youth in the United States are listening to Jim Tillman. Right now, you got 5 minutes to talk to the youth. What are you telling them?
Follow your heart. Ooh. Not tradition, not to please your parents, not to please your teacher. And you may follow your heart and accomplish that by pleasing your parents and teacher. But you've got to follow your heart. Don't get a degree and go to school and be this just because
everybody else is.
Somebody else was that.
Mm.
Now, if that's where your passion is, absolutely. But I think a lot of times, you know, when I was in high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do at 17, 18, 19, and they don't know either.
Yep.
Like I'm supposed to decide what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And I followed my heart. It's
Follow your heart. I like that. What impact would you want to leave in the world when it's all said and done? What do you want the world to remember you like?
He cared. Mm. He was passionate about what he did.
Yeah.
It wasn't opinionated. It was research-based. It was as factual as it could be. And he just enjoyed sharing stories. And he enjoyed learning from other cultures. I want to die empty. I don't want to take anything to the grave with me.
Yeah.
Give it all. Here True. You go. I think at the end of the day, God will be very pleased with me. That's really what it's about. You know, this is my calling. That's a powerful thing when you know
your calling.
Without a doubt that, okay.
Well, how would you put, what do you say your calling is in a very simple way?
My calling is to preserve history, share history in the most honest form I can.
Man, anything else you want to add, Jim?
No, this has been cool. This is my history. My first podcast ever.
Oh, is it?
I've never done a podcast.
Oh man, you're making another history.
Exactly.
Well, Sioux City's own, man. It depends how old you are. Some call him young OG. Some call him the OG. Some call him historian, storyteller. Man, Jim, thanks for being on the show.
Appreciate you, and I can't wait for the next time you have me on here.
Yes, sir. I think you're going to be a repeated offender.
That's good.
Because you got a lot going on, man.
That's good.
And I would like to be the one to highlight it.
And your podcast is going to help get it out there, and the things that I'm doing here, we can do in other Iowa communities.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right.
All right.